I'd like to call to order this hearing of the Tax Reform Division of the Senate Committee on Taxes, Tuesday, March 11th. I apologize for the tardy start. The first item on our agenda is approval of the minutes from March 3rd, 2014. Take a minute, please, members, and look over the minutes. Is there anyone who needs to make a correction to what's in front of us? Seeing none, Senator Dietzick moves approval of the minutes. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. We have two bills before us today dealing with sales tax exemptions, modifications for purchases and sales to local government, and a bill that deals with construction contracts that are authorized by local governments to through contractors, and we're looking at ways there to streamline that process of an exemption that already exists, but there's a lot of paperwork with it. So we will begin that. Senator Thune.
While we're waiting for Senator Rest to get to the table there, I see some students here today. We're wondering who you are and what you're here for. All right, students. It's good to see you, and welcome to the committee today. Okay, committee, we have before us Senator Rest's bill, Senate File 1860. Senator Rest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Senate File 1860 is a proposal that has come to our attention following the 2013 omnibus tax bill's enactment of sales tax exemptions for purchases made directly by local governments that had 20-some years ago become subject to the sales tax. And what we were trying to do in that bill was to undo that sales tax imposition. And following the passage of that bill, we heard from local governments that indicated that within these past couple of decades that there have been other instrumentalities that have had a relationship to local governments that perhaps were not in place at the time or that were not anticipated, and that they are joint powers agreements, for example, that are formed in order to have a more efficient delivery of services. And the argument was made that we should consider then this year expanding or extending, better I think is the word, extending the sales tax exemption on purchases to those entities as well. So that is the background of this, of Senate File 1860. And then another provision that perhaps has generated even more discussion in certain quarters is the those incidents where a local government is in competition delivering the same kind of service, is not an identical service, with a private business, and that the private business should not be operating at a disadvantage because the local government or one of the instrumentalities is purchasing or offering services to be purchased by the public that are absent the sales tax. And so we address that issue in this bill as well. I do have, Ms. Pollack, I have two amendments. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair and Senator Rest, there is just one amendment to Senate File 1860, the A2.
Okay. So aside. Then, Mr. Chairman, as an author's amendment, I move the A2.
All right. Is this in the folder?
Ms. Pollack? I guess
Mr.
not.
Chair and Senator Rest, I have copies for distribution.
Okay. Thank you. And
Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Rest, do you know, does the Department of Revenue revenue estimate include the amendment or not?
Senator Rest.
I would, Mr. Chairman, I'd have to ask Ms. McQuay.
Mr. Chair and Senators, the revenue estimate is estimated to the bill as introduced. However, in our conversations with the Department of Revenue, we believe that this is clarifying language recommended by the department and likely will not change the revenue estimate, but we'll have them look at the language again to ensure that.
So, Mr. Chairman, Senator Scoy, so the amendment clarifies what's already in the bill rather than adding additional entities that would be exempt from the sales tax. Okay. And what's done there is to add, in a sense, a new paragraph, a new numbered paragraph that allows the instrumentalities to be defined by existing law. So there's a reference to statutory sections. It's a fairly short bill.
Okay, Senator Rest moves the author's amendment, the A2 amendment. All in favor, say aye.
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 Any opposed? The motion carries. The A2 amendment is adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I believe I have explained the bill. I believe it's fairly straightforward in at this point in listing those entities that are going to be now included in the sales tax exemption, and I think we're ready to hear testimony. Unless people have other questions.
Okay. Any questions, members? Okay.
Mr. Chairman, and there is the revenue estimate dated March 6th. So that the impact for FY 2015 is $28.7 million. in tax relief for these entities, and the effective date is purchases after June 30th of 2014.
Okay, Senator Rest, should we move to testify?
I think you're here.
Okay. On the list of testifiers, the first person I have up is Brian Litze.
I think they moved to two tax committees.
Okay, are you Sarah Larson?
I am Sarah.
Okay. Welcome to the committee, both of you. And before you speak, if you could identify yourself for the tape and who you represent. Thank you.
I could start if that's okay. Mr. Chair and senators, I appreciate the opportunity to be here. When I started this profession, I didn't need these. I do now. So you can bear with me with the glasses. My name is Brian Litze. I'm Chief of Police for the South Lake Minnetonka Police Department, which for the past 40 years has provided quality policing for the cities of Excelsior, Greenwood, Sherwood, and Tonka Bay, pursuant to a joint powers agreement. I believe we're actually one of the longest entities of its type in the state in terms of a law enforcement function. I appreciate having the chance to testify at this hearing on behalf of the South Lake Minnetonka Police Department and other joint powers organizations that were excluded from the legislation passed last year that extended the sales tax exemptions to virtually every other political subdivision in the state. There's now an opportunity to correct this oversight by amending Minnesota Statute 297A.70 to include joint powers entities and special districts under the definition of local governments. I believe you have been provided with copies of my letter to Revenue Commissioner Myron Franz and the resolution passed by the Governing Board for the South Lake Minnetonka Police Department. Both these documents make the case for why joint powers entities should be eligible for the sales tax exemptions under Minnesota Statute 297A.70. If I could, I'd just like to read into the record the aforementioned resolution, which captures the evidence essence of my appearance here today. The resolution is our governing board. It's called the Coordinating Committee for the South Lake Minnetonka Police Department. It's made up of the mayors from each of the cities that I referenced earlier. In the resolution 214-1, resolution in support of joint powers organizations being granted new sales tax exemption under Minnesota Statute 297A.70, whereas for more than 40 years, the South Lake Minnetonka Police Department has been providing police services for the cities of Excelsior, Greenwood, Sherwood, and Tonka Bay, pursuant to a joint powers agreement authorized by Minnesota Statute 471.59, and whereas this partnership arrangement is an economical way to provide a full array of police services that no one city could realistically support on their own, and whereas the state of Minnesota should support such partnerships by including, not excluding, joint powers organizations from the new sales tax exemption for local governments that took effect on January 1, 2014, pursuant to Minnesota Statute 297A.70, and whereas by all indications, Minnesota Statute 297A.70 was intended to include not exclude joint powers organizations and other types of special districts in the state from realizing the cost-saving benefits derived under this statute. Now, therefore, be it resolved that the Coordinating Committee for the South Lake Minnetonka Police Department hereby appeals to the Minnesota Department of Revenue to recognize joint powers organizations as being eligible for the new sales tax exemption under Minnesota Statute 297A.70, and further, the Coordinating Committee appeals to the Minnesota Legislature to amend the aforementioned statute during the 2014 regular session to specifically mention joint powers organizations and special districts under the definition of local governments. This was adopted by our board on February 26, 2014, and signed by the committee chair, Jerry D. LaVega, who's mayor of the city of Tonka Bay. I would also like to highlight an important consideration that perhaps has been overlooked until now. The exclusion of joint powers entities and special districts under this statute that we're talking about today has a chilling effect on collaborative efforts between local units of government all across the state. one of the core elements of entering into cooperative agreements is to reduce the cost to taxpayers while providing equal or greater service through the pooling of resources and eliminating costly duplication in personnel, equipment, and infrastructure. Cooperative ventures like the South Lake Minnetonka Police Department should be encouraged and rewarded by the state, not discouraged and penalized by legislation that fails to grant them the same legitimacy as many other political subdivisions in the state. This disparity needs to be addressed sooner rather than later before real damage is done. There's been a groundswell of bipartisan support for the legislation before you that will give joint powers entities and special districts the same consideration as other local units of government. When it comes to this statute, it's not only the right thing to do, but it will encourage local governments around the state to work together to achieve greater efficiency, which I believe is our common goal here. I do thank you for the opportunity to speak about this important issue, and I welcome any questions that you might have.
Okay, thank you. Any questions for the testifiers, committee members? Okay, good. Thank you, Mr. Litze.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Ms. Larson, identify yourself for the record, please.
I am Sarah Larson, and I am the fire chief of the West Metro Fire Rescue District, serving the cities of Crystal and New Hope.
Okay, thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, Senators, thank you for this opportunity to testify on Senate File 1860. The West Metro Fire Rescue District was formed in 1998. We are a joint powers department formed by the cities of Crystal and New Hope. It was determined at the time of conception to be in the best interest of the two cities for the health, safety, and welfare of their communities to create and organize a joint fire department to provide effective and economical fire suppression services. Our mission today builds upon that original intent. We value fiscally prudent, efficient fire services for the communities we serve. We accomplish this through response, prevention, and education. The district responds to approximately 1,500 calls for service per year. We do that with a paid-on-call fire department, community members that serve the fire department. They are not paid to be there unless they're working. They are supported by a full-time staff of six. We do administrative work, and we also respond to calls for service. We are tasked with providing quality yet fiscally prudent services. The district has an annual general operating budget of $1.6 million, and with pension and capital, that increases to $2 million. Our only revenue is from the two cities. We are exempt from sales tax on the purchase of apparatus and personal protective equipment like turnout gear and self-contained breathing apparatus. Last year, we spent nearly $7,000 in sales tax. As a joint powers, we do pay to maintain our buildings, and we pay for utilities. Shared services are important, especially in this day and age, and should be encouraged. Not only for the quality of service, but also for their efficiency. We have joint fire academies, we buy equipment together, provide mutual aid and auto aid with our neighbors. This sales tax bill is important to our endeavor to provide our services, especially what is essentially a fire department to two cities. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Questions for the testifier? All right. Thanks, Ms. Larson. Next person on the list testifiers is Kay Arola. Okay. Welcome to the committee, and identify yourself for the tape, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Kay Arola. And I am here speaking this morning in favor of Senate File 1860. I represent the MACAC organization. I'm the president this year. MACAC is the Minnesota Association of Community Corrections Act Counties. And I'm also here as the director of Arrowhead Regional Corrections. MACAC represents 17 agencies that provide correctional services in the state of Minnesota that were formed under the Community Corrections Act. In total, we provide a a little over 70% of all of the probation services in the state. Seven of the agencies that are within MACAC are multi-county agencies, and they would represent 22 different counties. I am the director of one of those multi-county agencies. Arrowhead Regional Corrections is a joint powers agency, which was formed in 1976 by the five counties that make up the Arrowhead region. Those counties are Lake County, Cook County, Couchiching County, Carleton County, and St. Louis County. The Community Corrections Act statute actually encouraged and supports counties in creating a regional approach to correctional services. It moves us in that direction for good reasons. It has been a very effective model in reducing redundancy of services, sharing resources, and creating more efficiencies. The actions of the legislature last year to reduce the government taxes and extend those savings to taxpayers, I believe, resulted in some collateral consequences by omitting joint powers. The collateral consequences are that, in effect, the five counties in ARC, for example, are all individually tax-exempt, but because they have formed joint powers to provide those services, they lose that tax exemption when they come to sit at the table as the executive board for Arrowhead Regional Corrections. This has created a disincentive for collaboration and efficiencies and is actually in conflict with the language and the support provided through the Community Corrections Act. As a result of that, we consider this a very high priority for MACAC and the counties that we serve, and we would ask that you support the passing of the Senate File 1860 with the revisions that were stated on the record this morning.
All right, thank you. Questions for Ms. Arola? All right, thank you. Next testifier, Mr. Doug Carnival.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Doug Carnival, McGranchay Carnival Law Firm, Minneapolis, representing the National Waste and Recycling Association, formerly known as the National Solid Waste Management Association, just recently changed their name. We're here not to talk about the issue that the previous testifiers talked about, but the change in the bill that would move the statute from a provision that says that goods and services that are generally provided by private businesses are not covered by this exemption. Because in the current statute, it says goods and services generally provided by private businesses, including but not limited to, it sets forth a list of those services. This bill would change that to a specific list of those services that are set forth in the language and strike the language that says generally provided by private businesses. And the reason I'm here is because waste and recycling and disposal services were not enumerated in the current law, but would not be among the list that's in the current bill. And we're here to ask you to consider adding waste recycling and disposal services like landfilling to that, because those services are generally provided by the private sector, in some cases by the public sector, but in many, many cases by the private sector. And I'm happy to answer any questions that you've got on that, Mr. Chair.
Chairman.
Senator Rest.
Waste management services is one in a list that I was just looking through my folder that I don't have, but I think somebody does have here, that quite frankly are still under consideration. And I'm going to read you the list. And there's always a tension between making a general law that then the department would have the discretion over whether the private entity is actually in competition with the local government or not. And the other side of that is to make a list of things that is clear to everyone. And on the first side, a general description like we've had before, again, leaves a lot of discretion, and you have to come and argue your case. And right now, the bill favors the specific list. And in addition to the current interpretation of private businesses that are not listed here, besides waste management, are private facilities now that provide housing, fitness and special interest classes, recreational and athletic facilities, banquet and private party facilities, aquatic facilities, and, quite frankly, cemeteries. What I would encourage those that are interested in that to do is to visit with representatives of local government and Mr. Carlson in particular, and Ms. Shaver-Pellinen, committee administrator for the division, to explore the possibilities of either expansion or to make sure that those services are correctly dealt with by the Department of Revenue, and whether it is a necessity to make sure that there's a bright line there to list them as well. I will point out that cemeteries themselves have a separate exemption for lawn care and the related services that are used in the maintenance of cemetery grounds. But it does remain a concern of ours. Right now, it is the liquor stores, gas and electric utilities, golf courses, marinas, health and fitness centers, campgrounds, cafes, or laundromats. And, you know, you might think that, well, aquatic facilities and fitness and special interest classes could come under the health and fitness center exception to the exemption. We're still willing to take a look at that and to see whether and to what extent there is a problem in interpretation by going to a list as opposed to the discretionary authority of the department. So we're still open on that, but I don't have an additional amendment today to the bill. But again, I would encourage anyone who is concerned about those exceptions to the exemption of the list that I've just mentioned, or maybe there are even additional ones, to visit with, particularly with Mr. Carlson and the department, of course, too, and Ms. Shaver-Pellinen, to see if they are actually any entities that actually engaged in those businesses that are currently local governments or the instrumentalities now that we are including in the bill. But I do appreciate Mr. Carnival bringing it to our attention, and we have had conversations with him in the past week and are sympathetic to his concern.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd be happy to work with Senator Rest and the others.
Senator Scoy.
I have two issues. First, Senator Rest, thank you for indicating your willingness to have further discussion on the contemplation of whether we should try to have an all-encompassing list or a general law because of that problems with both of them. We're trying to work this out. And I don't know if we're done with this section or not, but at some point, Mr. Chair, I was hoping we could have somebody from the Department of Revenue come forward to talk about the revenue estimate, and maybe Mr. Carlson could also come forward at that time when we're done with the public testimony part.
Okay. Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm also looking forward to hearing what the Department of Revenue has to say about the revenue note. But this section, as Mr. Carnival has pointed out, is a pretty messy and subjective list.
Yep.
And when you get to those lists, the next thing you know, the next legislative session, we're going to have somebody else in looking for different treatment and to be included or excluded from a list. And boy, it gets very contentious when we do that. I sure hope we don't head down that road. But I want to understand, Mr. Carnival, if you can explain just a little bit about how these lists would, how they currently apply and how they don't. I know that you did that, but what are you saying that because these garbage haulers provide services to the city is not paying sales tax now under the current law because of this provision, and if that we take it away, the city will then have to pay? Or is it the inputs to the garbage companies when they provide those services?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ortman, a better example probably is landfills, where there are private sector landfills and there are county landfills, and they literally compete against each other for waste. There's no law that requires people to take waste to particular landfills. With respect to the issue of hauling, for instance, the city of Maplewood just went to a new system where they're going to decide who hauls garbage. They'll make that decision. They've selected a hauler to contract with. Now, I don't know whether this tax exemption would apply to the city. The city did, in fact, buy carts for the hauler, so the city made that purchase, or whether there's some way to transfer some of the exemption to the contractor through contract with them. So it's difficult for us to understand exactly what would be exempt and what's not. As you know, waste hauling and disposal services are kind of a patchwork quilt in this state, depending on the community and how they handle it. So we're still trying to understand the implications of this, and we'd be very interested in hearing what the department says with respect to now, who is exempt and who isn't. And frankly, if we're going to make a list, if a city decides to get into the waste hauling business in the future, and their purchases are exempt, obviously that's going to have an impact on the private sector as well. And frankly, the city of Minneapolis is currently half in the waste hauling business. So there are some nuances and complications depending on which aspect of the business you talk about.
Mr. Chairman, I think Senator Ortman and Senator Skoy, it really is important to have comment from the department as to whether the estimate is based solely on those things that are listed here, or if it is would be more generally that they believe that they already are including those other ones that I read off, including the waste management, generally waste management, although maybe the biggest concern is competition between the landfills. So maybe now is the time, Mr. Chairman, to hear from the department, unless Senator Ortman wants to make a further comment.
Mr. Chair, just very briefly, the landfill is an excellent example because the private landfill company can't compete with the government-run landfill company if the government landfill company doesn't have to collect sales taxes or pay it to itself. And so that local government is going to choose the government-run entity every single day of the week, because they can save that much money, which just adds to the growth and the expansion of local government. Because from what I've seen, local governments are always looking to increase their revenues, and a new stream of revenue would be to open up the landfill and compete with the private sector landfill company. And so I think this is as important a precedent and line to draw in the sand as any. I'm hopeful we get it right. Mm-hmm. I'm really appreciative that you came, Mr. Carnival.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I couldn't agree more. So that's why we're trying to be very deliberate about whether we can even come up with an exhaustive list, or whether we want the discretion to be solely with the department on a case by case basis.
Senator,
so maybe the department could speak now.
Senator Dziek.
Thank you. I just had a quick follow-up to what Senator Ortman said, and Mr. Carnival mentioned that the city of Minneapolis does have both private and public right now, and so, I mean, that's in one city that you could have a lot of impact either way. So if you could find that out, that would be great.
And Mr. Chairman, I would ask the department to tell us right now what they how they deal with public versus private enterprise landfills right now under the current law. Are they taxed? The cities pay sales tax or ask their customers to pay sales tax or not?
Okay. Welcome to the committee. Identify yourself for the record, please. Thanks.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jenny Starr, S-T-A-R-R. I'm the senior manager for tax policy at the Department of Revenue. And if I understand the question correctly, current law does not provide an exhaustive list of the items that are not exempt because they compete with private businesses. There's a partial list, but not a complete list. The department does consider waste management services to be one of those items that competes with private business and then therefore does not receive the exemption from sales tax. Does that answer the question, Mr. Chair?
I think members.
So, Mr. Chairman?
Senator Rest.
So would the department have an opinion about whether we should, you know, start this long list as in the current bill, or should we attempt a more precise general law description? And then I'd also be interested in a response from the cities to that same question.
Ms. Starr.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rest, the department understands the concern or the policy decision that's being made here, and in conversations with the author and with others who are interested in this issue, we have expressed that while an exclusive list does provide clarity for everybody involved, an exclusive list is also not dynamic and requires work to make sure that legislative intent on what is or isn't competing with private business is reflected in the list. If an exhaustive list is not the policy choice that's made, the department certainly would continue to work with interested people to make sure the information in our fact sheets and other information we provide to taxpayers is more useful to everybody, and so that clarity can be provided.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Rest.
So, Ms. Starr, if the new language on line 220 and 221 were removed and the old language was reinstated, would there be any entities on this list that you have as well that that if they were run by local governments, school districts, whatever, that they would be exempt?
Ms. Starr.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rest, so currently the department, in addition to the items that are listed in law, interprets the following to be things that compete with private business: waste management, housing facilities, fitness and special interest classes, recreational and athletic facilities, aquatic facilities, cemeteries, and banquet and private party facilities. And that's information that we have shared with others, and certainly we are looking at draft fact sheets right now to make that list available and clear to those who are interested.
Mr. Chairman, does how do you know that a local government that through its rec department is offering fitness and special interest classes is charging sales tax? Is it audited by you or by the state auditor? Who does that?
Ms. Starr.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rest, certainly this is part of our sales tax laws and something that the Department of Revenue reviews and audits in the normal course of our business. I'm sorry, though, I can't tell you exactly how we do that. And I imagine it gets into audit criteria, which is something that I can't share here at committee. Sure.
Senator Rest.
So, Mr. Chairman, I would like to hear from Mr. Carlson. I do think it is a real policy decision whether we want a list or whether we want the more teeth in the general law, more precision. And I don't have a opinion either way.
Okay. Thank you, testifiers. Mr. Carlson?
Ms. Starr?
Oh.
Stay at the table, please.
Oh. There you go. You're not out. Oh, done.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Gary Carlson. I'm with the League of Minnesota Cities, and I think Keith Carlson and Bo Berenson from the counties are also here to answer any questions you might have. Let me say that looking at this, goods and services generally provided by a private business is an addition that came into state statute in 2011 when we added a township exemption to the 297A70 statute. And as we met with the Department of Revenue over the summer, we realized that townships don't do many things that really cross over into this kind of goods and services generally provided by private business. And so it was really an untested provision in law in many respects until we added cities and counties to the exemption. Let me just remind you that prior to 1992, when cities and counties and towns were again taxed by the state, or I guess I should say for the first time taxed by the state, there was no carve-out for goods and services generally provided by a private business. No matter what we did, be it a municipal enterprise that may have been, quote, in competition with a private business, it was exempt from the sales tax. This was, again, a provision that went in 2011. I should say also that I tried my best to convince Senator Ress to just repeal all this statute, and she said no. And so we were trying to come up with an idea that would make it a more defined list of services so that we would have some assuredness at the local level what would be and what would not be taxed. And let me just give you one example of where I think the current law is ambiguous. There's an entity that couldn't be here today, LOGIS, the Local Government Information Service, that provides a lot of data processing services to cities and counties. And all of its participants and all of the services that it provides to local units of governments of one form or another. And it does that jointly because it was found to be more efficient to do that kind of service jointly. And it was determined under this particular provision of law, the goods and services provision, that it provides a service generally provided by private business and therefore should be taxed in its inputs. We felt that it's not competing, it's not providing its services to private individuals, to private citizens, to private businesses, that it should not be subject to the tax because it's really supplanting the requirements that each individual city and county that participate in LOGIS would otherwise do themselves. So maybe the underlying statute just needs to be clarified more. We thought that a good first stab would be to try to limit to a defined list, and the defined list is the list that was actually enacted in 2011 under Senator Ortman's bill, omnibus tax bill in 2011. We're willing to discuss, and I did discuss with Mr. Carnival yesterday, the issue of the waste management services, and I indicated to Senator Rest we would be willing to further discuss anything else that maybe should be added to the list.
Senator Scoy?
Thank you. If we're done with this aspect,
can we go back to the explanation
Mr. Chair, one brief comment about this section. I'm just not, whether it was a part of any other bill before, I'm just not a fan of the list. And I think we'd be much better off, as I was mentioning to Senator Scoy, going back to redefine what we mean by local government under this section, rather than trying to come up with a list of what type of transactions we're trying to tax. It might be a way to work through this problem.
Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Rest, Ms. Starr, and Mr. Carlson. Last year when we enacted the city and county exemption for sales tax, I believe the revenue estimate from the department was somewhere in the neighborhood of $130 million. We've had some discussions with the local units of government that received that relief, and I think their idea and list of benefits that the local units actually received was somewhere, and this is not going to be a precise number, but around $60, maybe $70 million, give or take. So there was quite a bit of discrepancy between what we had to count in our spreadsheet and pay for last year and what the benefits that the local units actually contemplated receiving. Now, that's all water over the dam, and I don't want to go back and revisit it, other than to say we are again looking at a revenue estimate that's $28 million for 15 and $30-plus million going off into the future, and so we're going to try to end up carrying those on a spreadsheet somewhere. And I'm just questioning about, so that we don't end up in the same situation that we ended up in last year and this summer, where the benefits that the local units think they received and what the state ends up paying for are so far out of line. And can you give me some discussion about where you think we are with regard to these costs? And then I'm going to ask the cities what they're, if they have any thoughts about, will they actually be receiving $30 million worth of benefit if we move forward on this?
Ms. Steyer.
Mr. Chair, Senator Skoy, I do know that our research division is aware of the skepticism of the revenue estimate, and I have asked them to review their methodology and explain some of it to me. And I understand that our revenue division has faith in the revenue estimate from last session and this revenue estimate on this bill, that they use state auditors' numbers, which is a methodology that they've been using for quite some time. And they tell me, just as a note, that its results are similar to those reported by the League of Minnesota Cities analysis back in 2001, and that we've been using what we believe to be a sound methodology since ever since.
Senator Skoy.
And Mr. Carlson, is there a reporting error that the cities are doing? Are you under-reporting? What are your thoughts with regard to these numbers?
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Skoy, you were referring in your initial comments before Ms. Starr responded to a report that was included in the omnibus tax bill last year. And under the omnibus tax bill, in conjunction with granting cities and counties the sales tax exemption, we had a reporting provision that required that we report, or all cities over 500 population and all counties report, how much sales tax they either actually paid or were estimated to have paid in 2012. When those numbers were compiled, the counties and the League of Cities compiled those all, added them all up, and the total we received in those numbers was about $54 million. Now, let me say that number is not an audited number. It's not definitive. I do know that there were a couple of cities that told me they only looked at their general fund impact and not at all of their special funds or enterprise operations. But that is a 2012 number, and the fiscal note that was created for the bill last year in the first full year of implementation, as I recall, had a state cost, a state loss of revenue of roughly $129 million. I'm not here to contest the department's numbers. I know our numbers are not necessarily 100% accurate either. We were just scratching our heads as to some apparent disconnect between what our cities and counties felt the benefit was going to be and what the department was booking the cost to be. I will say this, that I honor and value the department's work on trying to come up with these estimates. I know it's hard work. I myself have looked and tried to look at the numbers from our individual cities, and it's very difficult to compile those numbers. So I'm not here to contest that number, but we do still acknowledge that there seemed to be quite a bit of discrepancy between what the carried number was for FY14 and what our cities and counties reported for FY12.
Senator Riss.
Mr. Chairman, right on the revenue estimate is, and according to Ms. Starr's testimony, the department bases its estimates on information that the cities provide and the local governments provide to the state auditor. From what you just said, you went directly to the cities as opposed to looking at the reports that were filed by the cities to the state auditor. And I wonder, do you know whether the reports that are filed with the state auditor separately state the amount of sales tax, or do they just file what their expenditures have been, including those items to which they were subject to the sales tax?
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rest, to my knowledge, the financial reporting to the state auditor does not itemize the actual sales tax paid to the state of Minnesota in those reports.
And, Mr. Chairman, a question for Ms. Starr again. If we took out that list, went back to the current law, even without making it more precise, would the revenue estimate vary with this list of a dozen and a half entities? Would it be any different, even though the discretion would once again be back with the department, even with the general language that's here?
Ms. Starr.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rest, if I understand your question correctly, you're asking if the language here changing the generally provided provision goes back to the way law is currently, would that have an impact on the revenue estimate?
Yes.
And if that's the question, the answer is yes, the cost on the revenue estimate would go down.
Mr. Chairman, that's counterintuitive to me. How would that work?
Mr. Chair, Senator Rest, the cost would change because currently the Department of Revenue interprets the law that we have to exclude a larger number of entities from the sales tax exclusion. More types of businesses provided by local government.
So there would be, Mr. Chairman, Ms. Starr, there would be, you talked about the cost, there would be less tax relief because more local governments would be considered to be in competition with private businesses, and so based on determinations made by the department, and the general law is beginning to look more and more attractive.
Ms. Starr.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rest, exactly. And when you asked me earlier for a list of things that we consider to be excluded, and I read the list, I did miss computing services.
Which is the LOGIS.
Which is the LOGIS, and the reason being, while LOGIS is not providing its services to individuals, the department views LOGIS to be competing with private businesses that could otherwise bid on and compete for the business of the client of the local government.
Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just briefly to Ms. Starr, just so I understand, the department's list is longer than the one that we have compiled here.
Ms. Starr.
Mr. Chair, Senator Scoy, correct.
And then, Mr. Chair, maybe to Mr. Carlson, I gave the example of LOGIS that provides services to cities, but it's a joint powers. So is that relevant to the generally provided by a private business discussion?
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Scoy, I believe it is, because when the department made its determination on LOGIS being exempt or not exempt, they based it partially on the fact that it was a joint powers, but partially on the fact that they deemed the services provided by LOGIS to generally be provided by a private business. But I just want to clarify, on that kind of endeavor, I mean, we could basically disincent any sort of collaboration of any local governments because, again, LOGIS doesn't market its services to anybody but those locals that decided to join into LOGIS. And it seems to me that we don't want to set up tax policy to disincent the collaboration of those entities as well. So I think we need to think about this very carefully and carefully define a line if that's the choice. But again, just simply because LOGIS does data processing services doesn't necessarily mean that, in my mind, that they should necessarily not be exempt, because then we're just telling local governments, do it yourself, and that's not an efficient way to handle those services either.
But Mr. Chairman, Mr. Carlson, wouldn't the local government, if it was more efficient, wouldn't they contract with another business entity that maybe had clients in the private sector as well as clients in local government, because it was cheaper to do it but through a contract than it was for the local government to do it itself, except that right now there's a monopoly, is what you're suggesting, of this one company that doesn't have but a single group of clients. Is that right?
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rest, I mean, I think that a city or a county could right now, if they got a lower bid, choose to do some of the data processing work through a private vendor. There's nothing to stop them. It's not a monopoly situation in my understanding of the way LOGIS operates. They do a lot of very specific work for governmental entities that's very specific to their needs. I'm not an expert in LOGIS. I apologize, and I did not have the opportunity to get them here today. But the entity was formed as a joint powers because all of the cities and counties that are participants needed to do the same type of data processing work, and they found it to be more efficient to do it jointly. And again, they do not market their services like to the waste haulers that are a private business. They basically do this at the behest of those participating local units of government.
Senator Artman.
Well, I think this is another really good example. I think with LOGIS, you don't exclude them because they're providing services to a joint powers, but you do exclude them because they are competing with the private sector. I think you have to, because the government entities don't want to be disincented to work together. I mean, I think they absolutely should be encouraged to work together. So if they're contracting for goods and services, they should be have access to that reduction in the price of the sales tax. But LOGIS does have competitors in the marketplace, maybe not here in Minnesota with active contracts, but there definitely are other computer companies that can do these kinds of things. I just don't think you want to see the expansion of government providing its own goods and services in order to take advantage of the sales tax exemption. I don't think we want to see that.
Well,
Senator
Mr. Chairman, Senator Wortman, it's not if the local government did it internally themselves, that would be provided those goods and services for themselves. That's one thing. It's the contract part. And I think you,
right.
I think, right. I mean, that's what you were saying. If they're contracting outside, regardless of who's doing it.
Exactly. And we may also have a problem with it. I mean, why are we treating goods and services the same? I mean, I think if you're going to have this conversation, we should really have this conversation. Maybe it's not services but only goods that should be exempt from the sales tax. I'm not offering any amendments. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying there may be different ways to parse this out that might make more sense.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Rest.
That's a very helpful observation and distinction. I thank Senator Orton for it.
Mr. Chair, I think there's another.
Mr. Chairman, members, I'm Keith Carlson with the Minnesota Intercounties Association, and there's several issues that have come up here that I'd like to comment on. First, with regards to the revenue analysis, there are basically three issues that are being captured here. One, the clarification or expansion of the sales tax exemption to joint powers entities. Two, the limitation of those services to which local governments will remain taxable on their inputs. Three, which has not been mentioned here, is the expansion of the sales tax exemption to all special districts. That was not a provision of last year's bill. This bill makes that expansion. Mr. Carlson, myself, Bo Berenson from AMC, met with the department yesterday, and we tried to get that delineation, but that has not been provided. But so just so the committee is clear, there are three different elements here, all of which could contribute to the total cost of $28,700,000 in the first year. Going to the issue of the specifically LOGIS or other entities like that, the primary reason why they exist is to provide one entity that will contract for common services or common goods for a number of cities or counties. I'm more familiar with the analogous service, the Minnesota County's Computer Consortium. They do in-house services for the counties that contract with them for a number of products that are unique to county government. But they also contract with private vendors to provide those services. For example, the current systems that administer the property tax system at the local system are basically contracted for with two separate private vendors. The efficiencies that counties derive by contracting for those services with the Minnesota Counties Computer Consortium is that a number of counties are contracting for that service through the joint powers entity rather than each individual county having to do that. So we get efficiencies of scale that are done. That's why we're looking for the clarification that this is a non-taxable, the inputs to it is non-taxable. Finally, with regards to what's the underlying thing of coming up with a specific list, we're just looking for clarity. We don't want to be caught in the situation where the Department of Revenue comes out and basically says, gotcha. We failed to realize that this might have been a service that they would deem where we had been in competition. And I'll give you a couple of examples. The list that they gave you verbally talked about athletic facilities. Basically, the current Department of Revenue position is that the inputs to baseball fields, basketball courts, are all services where we're in competition with the private sector. And I'd frankly challenge any members of the committee to come to the same conclusion. Most members of Minnesota expect that that's a service provided by their cities, basically, and don't think that, well, maybe I can go to the private vendor of baseball fields or the private vendor of basketball fields. Another confusing issue is that the current Department of Revenue policy on pools is that if it's operated by a city or a county, it's taxable. If it's operated by a school district, which I believe are the lion's share of the publicly operated pools in the state of Minnesota, it's a non-taxable event, or the inputs to it is non-taxable. That's why we're looking for clarification on this list. The statute is very confusing. You'll see the reference to local governments under the clause that's being amended. You have to read further in the statute. It's only referring to cities, counties, and townships there. It is not referring to school districts. That's the basis of the distinction under the current department interpretation, that if it's provided by a school district, it's exempt. The inputs to it are exempt. If it's provided by a city or county, it's taxable. So, again, that's the underlying reason why we're looking for clarification as to these specific programs and services where so we have clarity up front knowing what is taxable and what is not.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Rest.
Nothing is ever simple.
That's right.
So, Mr. Chairman, I don't know if there are other questions, but it's not my intention to move any amendments beyond the one that I already offered today, but I do think that that particular provision, the competitive nature or what is or what is not taxed relative to whether it's offered by a local government, or Mr. Carlson has now said, well, if it's a school district, their home's got free all the time, then we need to do a little bit more further work on those particular provisions. Unless members have any questions, Mr. Chairman, Senator Scoy, it was just my intent to just lay the bill over at this point, unless you want it moved up to the full committee. But I just assume keep it here.
I think you should keep it here, Senator
okay.
Rest.
Mr. Chairman, and then I would request that Senate File 1860, as amended, be laid over, and first, and then I have a comment.
Okay. Any questions before I do that? Okay. Senate File 1860, as amended, is laid over.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I would ask those that are interested in that particular paragraph in the law to be in contact with Ms. Schaefer-Pellinen, with Mr. Peterson, with Ms. McQuay and the department, and representatives from the counties and the cities. And perhaps even we should be reaching out to the school districts, too, to see how they regard this section of the law, to make sure that we're not, although we should be providing incentives to for local government cooperation with one another and not penalize them for that, but it's a separate issue from what kinds of purchases either the cooperative units or the local governments in their own name, their activities that they are supporting and or purchases that they're making. So, Mr. Chairman, with that, I would like to turn now to Senate File 1862.
Okay, committee, before us is Senator Rest's bill, Senate File 1862.
And, Mr. Chairman, I have a page and line amendment to Senate File 1862. It's the A.
Mr. Chair and Senator Rest, there's an A-10 delete everything amendment.
The A-10 rather than the A-11. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair and Senator Rest, the A-11 is then a page and line amendment to the delete all. So the division would need to adopt the
both.
Delete all amendment
okay.
first.
Okay. So, Mr. Chairman, I would move the A-10 amendment, author's amendment.
Okay. Does everybody have a copy yet? Just
thank you. Thanks.
Okay, before us is the author's amendment, the A-10 amendment. Senator Rest moves the A-10 amendment. All in favor, say aye.
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 Any opposed? The motion carries. The A-10 amendment is adopted.
And then, Mr. Chairman, I would further offer the A-11 amendment, which is a page in line to the delete all.
Okay, committee, everybody has the A-11? Senator Rest moves the A-11 amendment, and Ms. McQuay?
Mr. Chair and members, the amendments were done separately because the department completed the revenue estimate on the delete everything for the A-10. As was the case with the previous Senate file, there was some clarifying going on with the changes on the A-11, and I know Ms. Pollack and the department are working diligently to reflect what is in the revenue estimate, though this estimate may change as a result of clarifications made in the A-11.
Mr. Chairman, did we adopt the A-11?
No, it's just it's moved, but not
okay.
We haven't
moved. Maybe we should adopt it so we can move on.
Okay. Senator Rest renews her motion to adopt the A-11 amendment. All in favor, aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The motion carries. The A-11 amendment is adopted.
Mr. Chairman, Rest. That I would refer members to both the revenue estimate that was done March 10th and then to the bill summary, which is done to the A10 delete everything amendment, and this is the situation. Right now, when a local government is going to build something, if they purchase the materials themselves, for the most part, those materials would be exempt from sales tax. However, if they have a contract with a private business that's going to do the project, and they have a contract that states the price for the building materials and the labor separately, it's still that way. But if it's not, then there is a very complicated process to provide an exemption, or for that matter of fact, there may not be any. And what this bill does is recognize the entities that is going to be the owner of the construction project as the determination of whether the material should be exempt. And the dilemma has been, well, what if the private business contractor buys $100,000 worth of materials to build a project for a city, and it's tax exempt, and they only use $90,000 worth of those materials, but they have $10,000 worth of materials that are tax exempt that they don't need for that project, and they hold on to them. How do we avoid that result, which is not the intent of the law? So the bill does a couple of things, but one of them is to deal with that exemption process so that it is it's more streamlined. It recognizes the entity that is the ultimate purchaser, that is the local government, and puts in place a refund process. Not an upfront exemption, but a refund process, which, as I understand it, makes it easier for the Department of Revenue to audit those actions because they're actually looking at an application rather than just a contractor going to a building supply place and showing an exemption certificate. Also, the issue of, well, there are other tax-exempt organizations that are in the same kind of position with regard to construction contracts as local governments, and those tax-exempt organizations need a parallel process to accomplish the same thing, and that would be a consistent tax policy to allow hospitals, for example, to take advantage of that as well. So that is the bill, and and I'm going to just ask that's what's in the A10, and then the A11. It reflects further work that we've done just in the last couple of days, and I'm going to ask Ms. Pollack to go through the A11. I just got it late last night, very early this morning, and did not have the bill in front of me to compare it to, and so I would ask her if she would do that now.
Ms. Pollack.
Mr. Chair and Senator Rest, under the A10 delete everything amendment, if I could just explain some background before I go on to explain the A11. There are four types of entities named that would be eligible to apply for, have their purchases for construction materials exempted if those purchases were made by their contractors. The A11 adds two additional types of entities. The first would be hospitals and nursing homes operated by political subdivisions of the state, and the second would be libraries, county libraries, and county law libraries. And these were local entities that were deemed to fall under the general policy of this provision to provide this additional means of achieving the sales tax exemption for these local government entities. And that language is on, of the A11 amendment, that's on 1.3 to 1.14. And then the rest of the A11 amendment simply contains the a cross-reference for the refund provisions that Senator Rest mentioned so that the contractors may receive the sales tax exemption for their purchases. I would note that the sales tax exemption would be applied for by the local government entity or the exempt entity and then remitted to the contractor.
So, Mr. Chairman, thank you, Ms. Pollack. You know, I can understand where some of the entities, the contractors, would prefer an even more streamlined process and have an upfront exemption rather than a refund. But I think prudence directs otherwise, and to have a refund process as described by Ms. Pollack is more responsible approach. It's kind of the trust and verify. But, Mr. Chairman, there are people who would like to testify, and I might indicate that one of them is a person who got me started on looking further into the nonprofits, et cetera, and I believe he's on the list, of Mr. Melcher from the Bar Association, I believe. There you go. But I don't have the list in front of me, so I don't know who we're starting with.
Okay, it looks like we got three people coming forward. Two people coming forward. Okay, well, whoever wants to start, identify yourself for the tape and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Patrick Hines with the League of Minnesota Cities. I wanted to thank Senator Rest for bringing this bill forward to the committee today and to thank the Department of Revenue for meeting with us multiple times to discuss our concerns. Senator Rest did a very good job describing the situation. Essentially, the construction materials now under current law are tax exempt if they are bought pursuant to statutory and regulatory guidelines. So the same 2x4 in a building can be exempt or not exempt simply based on the type of contract that is used for the project and based on what type of contractual arrangement a city has with a contractor. The system, as Senator Rest indicated, is complicated. And I would like to point out it's not simply a matter of cities not wanting to do paperwork. We understand that there are going to be hoops to jump through in order to claim the exemption. We would simply like to change the type of hoop and change the number of hoops we have to go through. And I have with me the city engineer from St. Paul, and he can explain in more detail the process that a city has to go through to claim it now and why that is problematic.
Okay, thank you. Welcome to the committee, and identify yourself for the tape, please.
Mr. Chair, John Matsko, city engineer with the City of St. Paul, and also representing city engineers, the City Engineers Association of Minnesota, who has to really implement and deal with the bill or bills in order to get the best price for our citizens. The current process is it is required as cities generally contract is based on accountability and responsibility. So we generally, when we build out a contract, we develop specifications, we go out to bid for the lowest responsible bidder, generally a general contractor, and then they're responsible for delivering the project, supplying the material, subcontractors, etc. There's many, as just like building a home or doing remodeling at your house, there are many components that go into construction projects, buildings such as this, park buildings, or roadway projects. So there's many different subcontractors and many different suppliers that have to be involved, concrete suppliers, asphalt suppliers, pipe suppliers, etc. And under the current process, we would have to bid those separate material purchases out separately, have a relationship between the product supplier and the city, and then we would bid separately a contract for labor and equipment in order to install it. So similar to your home, if you're doing remodeling, you would be responsible for going and purchasing the material and achieving the tax benefit, but then you would hire a labor an equipment person to put it up. The problem with that gets to be twofold. Number one, managing the multiple contracts that are involved, and secondly, if the material it doesn't come on time, there's shortages, or if there's a problem with the material, the delays that are caused with that, the responsibility for the contractor to take responsibility becomes very clouded. If the roof starts to leak shortly, you know, after the construction, was it a material issue, which a contractor may claim? Is it a contractor issue, which the material manufacturers may say because of the way it was installed? Similarly, when we're buying asphalt, concrete, pipe, etc., it becomes a clear issue of liability, which in the long run costs cities much more to manage the multiple contracts, much more if there's disputes between contractors, material suppliers, etc., and ultimately ends up costing cities and more money than had we just not gone through the process altogether. So at this point, from a practical perspective, as city engineers, we would just love to have it exempt right up front, but there's also the concern, as Senator Rust had mentioned, with suppliers, etc. But because we can require contractors when they bid to give us a cost on the material side of things, and it's left to the cities then to do the request, no contractor is benefiting one way or the other by having a certain amount of material on hand or not on hand, yet the taxpayers that we represent and the citizens that we do work for would achieve the benefit of a reduction at that point. So we urge support of the bill as Senator Rest has proposed.
Okay, thank you. Questions, committee? Okay, thank you. The one person left on the list I have, Mr. Stephen Melcher. Welcome to the committee. Identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Steve Melcher, and I am coming to you representing the construction law section of the Minnesota Bar Association, but specifically the construction law section only. I practice in construction law, have for over 20 years. I represent project owners, contractors, project designers, subcontractors, suppliers. And I have, over the last 15 years, done almost an uncountable number of seminars and presentations to industry groups trying to explain to them how to comply with the exemption that we're talking about today. And so I am very excited about this bill, and I'm very thankful to the League of Minnesota Cities for spearheading the effort this year. It's been on our radar in the construction section for a number of years, and we haven't yet taken it forward, and we're very excited that it's moving forward this year. I don't have a personal axe to grind or any benefit to be derived from the passage of this bill. In fact, I spend a lot of hours every month advising clients on how to comply with this very current, with the current very tricky procedures. Nevertheless, I would be very happy to see this bill enacted. I think it is in perfect keeping with the uncession. It's a great example of removal of cumbersome and costly procedures and simplifying our laws. As you've already heard, the current law requires a complicated bifurcated process for both bidding and contracting any construction projects by the entities that we have intended to receive tax exemptions for their materials on those projects. There are many types of projects that already do have exemptions under current law, and they're mostly found under the construction exemptions under 297A.71, where this procedure absolutely just doesn't apply. And there are also many other examples outside of 297A.71. For example, Indian tribes is one, but there are other that come to mind, waste, product expenditures, et cetera, probably a dozen, where these procedures just don't exist, which says to me that these procedures probably aren't necessary. It's an unnecessary, very cumbersome, tricky procedure that's costly to comply with and puts all of these exempt entities at risk of being caught by surprise at the end of the project that they owe taxes. Perhaps they're going to have to have some arguments with the Department of Revenue over the assessment of penalties and interest. It's a simplification that I think is long overdue. Just to put it in perspective, these exemptions that we're talking about, the parties that we're talking about largely, government entities and nonprofits, have had an exemption since 1967. And they've only been encumbered with this specific procedures that we're trying to simplify today in 1984. So there are many years where these procedures weren't even in existence for these very entities. And maybe it's coincidental, but perhaps this is one of those Orwellian laws that it's time to get away with. It came to us in 1984. Our section is very glad that it is extending this to cities and municipalities and school districts, and also by the amendments that have been made this morning to other tax-exempt entities. In talking to some of the associations that represent the constituencies involved, I have found that there is broad support for the simplification. The principle behind simplifying the sales tax exemption is supported by at least two that I can report today, the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits and the Minnesota Council of Churches. I do not want to be a fly in the ointment on this endeavor. I will say that there are just a couple of things about the pay and get a refund later approach that make me a little concerned. I want to bring those to your attention so that you can consider those in your deliberations going forward. First of all, I'm sure you're aware that under the construction exemptions in 297A.71, which this statute now will refer the exempt entities to achieve their exemptions on construction projects, there are some 30 specific exemptions there, some that are specifically aimed at a particular project and others that are aimed at certain types of construction projects without looking at the specific one-time-only project. Of those 30, 17 of them do not require a pay-and-seek-refund-later approach. So you might want to look at that and say, is there a reason we can't do this more broadly? I'm particularly, though, concerned about this aspect of it. If you are dealing with an exempt entity that has to go through the process of authorizing appropriations for a project, and this is going to be probably most applicable to governmental entities, but not solely governmental entities. When they go through the appropriations process to fund a project, they're going to say, for example, and I'll use some round numbers because it's easier for me. Let's say we're going to fund a $15 million project. That's our budget. We've raised it. We know we can spend it, and that's what we think we need to build it. Then they'll go out and have it. They'll get the appropriation. They'll go out and have it designed to reach that. But they're going to have to include the cost of the tax in that process. On a $15 million project, let's just say it's half materials. You've got a $500,000 sales tax chunk in that $15 million. What's going to happen is they're going to build this project. They're going to spend the $15 million, everything that they had. At 6 months or a year later, they're going to get a refund. Now they're going to have $500,000 cash reserve on a project that's done, completed, long time ago. What are they going to do with these funds? So they're not really able to take a full advantage of the tax exemption because it comes to them after the project is done. So that's my concern about it. If there was a way to avoid that, that would be helpful.
Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the issue that the witness just brought up, could they deal with that in their contingency?
The contingency is something that is resolved during the construction project. materials are going to continue to be purchased throughout the life of the project. The project is completed. Final payment is made. The contingency is null at that point. It has no meaning. They may have a contingency in their coffers, but it doesn't. That's just more money that they didn't spend. So I do not think so. I think that at the end of the day, if they built in a $500,000 contingency for sales tax purposes, and they spent everything they could, and therefore got full use of that appropriation, 6 months or a year later, when they get that refund, they're going to have a $500,000 cash reserve and no project to spend it on. It's hard for me to come up with a solution to that, but that's the only drawback to the pay and refund aspect that I can think of.
Senator Scoy?
Oh, that's okay.
Okay. Anything?
Mr. Chair. And members, I would just like to clarify that the current law requirement and the applicable rule to the construction contracts would still apply under this bill as amended for other entities, for example, the federal government and its agencies. The construction requirement rule would still apply to those projects. It is just those that are named in the bill as amended that would be allowed to have the construction exemption provided as in 297A.71.
Mr. Chairman, I would also remind members to look at the second page of the revenue estimate and to remind us that the state itself and its subdivisions like the University of Missouri, not a subdivision, it's a constitutionally independent group like the University of Minnesota, but then also MNSCU, they do pay sales tax. State agencies, et cetera, pay sales tax to the state. It's a policy that dampens their budgets in terms of what they can afford and so forth. So we do, they are not excused from paying sales tax in any of these bills that we've been bringing forward. It's strictly the local governments, and then in with the A11 amendment, we're referencing some other related nonprofit, not or tax exempt entities, but it's not, and including the Legislative Reference Library. They're not included in this. So I just want to make sure that we don't think that either what we did in 2013 or what we may be able to do in this year, that it totally removes, we're totally removing a sales tax from all government entities, not the federal government, not except according to the rules that we have, nor state government entities as well. I think we sometimes forget that.
Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Rest, I wonder if we could bring somebody from the department up to talk about the administration of this for the department. And members, from what I've heard from the testimony today and from my previous experiences, because this issue has been around for a while with regard to school districts, is because of this cumbersome process that has been in place, basically they haven't been getting the sales tax exemption. I mean, that's what the impact of this has been. I know when a couple of the school districts in my area were building buildings, the school board was having an extremely difficult time understanding why, because they went through a contractor, they weren't able to take advantage of this. So hopefully that's part of what we're going to resolve. But I'd also like to hear from the department.
Yeah, and, Mr. Chairman, Senator Scoy, we're attempting to make it easier, but not to make it easy. Mm-hmm. I guess that's the way I would describe what this bill does.
Ms. Starr.
Mr. Chair, Senator Scoy, the department was very pleased to be able to work with the author and to others who are concerned about this area. Our primary concern was about transparency, and the refund provision here allows for the transparency necessary to correctly and efficiently administer the law.
And Mr. Chair, Ms. Starr, do you think the protections are in place to ensure that the materials that are getting exempt are actually used on the project, and that not easy, but easy enough that local units will actually be able to take advantage of the sales tax exemption?
Ms. Starr.
Mr. Chair, Senator Scoy, my understanding is this bill uses a refund provision that is already in law and that the department is already familiar with and can administer. You're correct, it may not be easy, but a refund law does allow taxpayers to show us the sales tax that was paid and to obtain the refunds that are appropriate under the law.
Mr. Chairman, I have I'm aware of no other testifiers, but there may be if we're close to the ending time for the hearing, but you may want to ask if there's anybody else.
Is there anybody else that would like to testify on this bill? I'm not seeing anybody.
Then, Mr. Chairman, if there's no other questions or comments from members, I would ask you also to lay over Senate File 1862 as amended.
All right. Any questions before I do that? All right. Senate File 1862 as amended is laid over.
And Mr. Chairman, I would ask Senator Scoy if he would just review the activities for the Tax Committee and the Division for the rest of the week.
Senator Scoy.
The committee is meeting on Thursday, and I believe TIF is on the agenda. So we have a series of bills relating to TIF provisions at
and local with regard to we're not meeting on Friday either in the division or the full committee, and with regard to Wednesday, Ms. Schaefer-Pellinen is
we just have a variety of bills on the agenda for tomorrow. Nothing, no specific topic.
And they're in the full committee or
in the division, division.
In
tomorrow
the division.
At 9 a.m.
So see you tomorrow.
Mr. Chair, can you just advise on the status of movement on tax conformity and any of the tax repealers or reinstatements, any of those provisions? I mean, the tax relief, people are waiting to hear what the Senate is going to do.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Ortman, we are scheduling Senator Scoy, and I believe we're going to kind of the division of labor to start with was sales tax issues, since that's where the reform started last year, would be heard in the division, and then conformity issues, and of course we heard the estate tax thing here too. But conformity issues would be heard in the full committee, and I think we're moving to that schedule. But Senator Scoy, maybe you know, I can't remember what you said about exactly when we're going to take up the
Senator
conformity
Scoy.
Bill.
And Mr. Chair, Senator Ortman, conformity is scheduled to be heard next Tuesday. And I specifically did not mention a Friday meeting because it's unclear as today as to whether we will have a meeting on Friday or not.
I will send
out an announcement either way as soon as we're clear on that.
Okay.
Thank you.
Then, Mr. Chairman, I think we're ready for the committee to adjourn.
All right. Nothing for... Okay. We're adjourned. Thanks.
Thank you.